This is the third session of the interview with John Ferry. It's now the 30th of October.
Do you want to start then?
Well, I just wanted to find out a little bit more. When you were appointed a junior fellow,
yes,
you must have felt as if you were, that was a really cream of the crop.
Well,
thing.
It was an interesting group, because everyone there felt that he'd been specially selected, of course, but we were all there together, and we were all equals, and so we didn't really feel as though we were on the top of the pinnacle, because there were a lot of us. I've forgotten whether it was about 20, I think.
20. Well, yeah. I mean, here you are at Harvard, which is generally thought to be the university in the country, and with this appointment, it must have felt wonderful to you at that point.
Well,
did it? Or
it made to a certain extent, but on the one hand, I was a little worried as to whether I would be able to produce to justify this distinction.
Is this something that's always afflicted you?
No, I got over it. Even then, I didn't have much time to stop and worry about such matters.
Uh-huh.
And after I got out here, I don't think I worried about it at all. I simply got down to business.
But at that time, you hadn't yet done anything that anybody had thought was earth-shaking, is that right?
Or even that I thought was earth-shaking.
Uh-huh.
So,
What basis? And they interviewed you,
yes,
though. On what basis do you think they decided to appoint you?
Probably Dr. Cohn's recommendation.
And why?
I didn't think I did very well in the interview.
Uh-huh.
In fact, I was quite depressed afterwards.
Oh, were you?
Yes.
But Dr. Cohn's recommendation wouldn't have been made lightly, presumably.
I'm sure it carried a great deal of weight.
Mm. But I mean, he didn't just say, "Well, here's a nice fellow working in my lab."
No.
He thought highly of you, a great deal of detail
to support his recommendation.
And this was on the basis of your work for him.
Yes.
So that must have been very successful.
Well,
that must have been. You said they liked what you had done.
Yes, although it wasn't highly original or anything. I was working along with J.L. Unkley, who had designed the apparatus that mm-hmm. I was using.
But what can you pin down? What it would be that would was it your methodicalness that they appreciated, or?
I really don't know. I participated in a lot of general discussions of things that were going on in the laboratory.
Oh, you did?
Yes.
And you were knowledgeable and.
Well, I was learning fast.
Yeah. Was it exciting for you working in the lab?
Yes.
I haven't gotten the impression it was really yet.
It was exciting, but it wasn't earth-shaking.
Which later things were. I know you did say that.
As soon as I got into my own work, as soon as I knew exactly what I wanted to do, then I was extremely.
Yeah. Well, you did say that before, and when you went back into polymer research,
yes,
that was kind of by default. Then it was something. What I mean, after you.
After you mean. When I was still in the Cohn laboratory?
Yes, when you started doing your own research and you said you picked up with the polymers again.
Well, I wouldn't say it was by default. It was because now I could really do what I wanted to do, rather than doing things that Dr. Cohn or someone else was interested in.
Yes, but you had said that you hadn't been terribly interested in this. Is your
yes.
PhD research?
Oh.
Or have you moved on to something really quite different then?
Maybe you'd better turn it off.
Okay.
Stop it. Perhaps I haven't made it clear that at the end of my PhD work, I saw a lot of unanswered questions that would be very interesting to follow up.
Uh-huh.
And I just had not had an opportunity to do it for a number of years, because mm-hmm. I was working with people and in groups that were primarily interested in other things. And in fact, very few people anywhere were interested in what I wanted to do, to investigate the phenomena of viscoelasticity.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was no particular long-range goal except curiosity as to why polymeric materials behaved in such peculiar ways.
Mm-hmm. So there wasn't any obvious application?
Not to me at the time. It developed later that there were many, many applications.
Yes.
And for that reason, the work we've done has been of great interest to people in industry and various kinds of industry. I mentioned adhesives the other
yes.
day.
Yes, oh yes, yeah.
Acoustics, control of noise and absorption
mm-hmm.
of sound, processing of polymeric materials, performance of rubber tires, and many, many other things.
But you wouldn't, the industrial application wouldn't have
It wouldn't have influenced me at all at that point. And indeed, for many years when we were turning out a lot of data here, I left the applications to other people
mm-hmm.
in other places.
So from your point of view, this was like trying to find out what's inside the atom and
yes.
what's inside the proton. And it's
more pedestrian problems than those, but personally, I could never get much interested in the inside of the atom. Well. Where do you want to proceed?
Said you had some comments on the
influence of people at Harvard on
that's
my
right.
scientific
yes.
approach. L.J. Henderson, in all of his work in chemistry and physiology over the years, had been interested in describing systems with many variables. You have scientific phenomena that depend on many variables. A lot depends on how you formulate the dependence. One formulation may lead you to no insight at all, but if you can arrange the variables suitably, then some important generalizations may drop out of the picture, which will give you considerable insight.
Mm-hmm.
And I could see how he had done that in a famous book he had written on blood chemistry in the 1920s, which I read. And E.J. Cohn, having been Henderson's disciple, was using a similar approach in his research on proteins and amino acids, which I absorbed partly perhaps by osmosis without conscious analysis of it.
Mm-hmm.
Another influence which involves something that Henderson was always talking about, scientific conceptual schemes. The development of a way of looking at a group of phenomena which would lead to alternating theory and experiment, a feature which is well known in the scientific method, but he described it in these terms, and I could see that in the development of a science, it was quite important to have a conceptual scheme accepted by a group of people working in the field. If everyone has his own conceptual scheme, then it's very difficult to communicate different vocabulary, a different way of looking at things. And when I began to work in earnest in viscoelasticity here, I was rather eager to have my conceptual scheme accepted generally. I wasn't interested in becoming famous particularly, but that was one thing I wanted to establish, my conceptual scheme and my notation, what the letters I would use to describe, to identify the different variables and how I would define the quantities I was working with. And that turned out fairly well. People did use my schemes, not that they were, it might not have mattered too much in the end, but I was pleased that that my schemes were pretty much adopted.
That's very interesting. It's superimposing a philosophy of science, then, is it, on what you're doing?
Well, it's more a matter of working. Maybe you better turn it off while I think of it.
Well, I worded my question wrong. Yeah. I didn't mean, I meant this is looking at what you're doing from the outside and structuring it, which you could perhaps do a whole life of scientific research and not do that. Is that possible?
Yes.
Not see the thing as a whole and try to shape it.
I'm really talking about the working procedures.
Yes, I know you are, but yes. I mean, if thinking, being able to put it into a phrase such as a conceptual scheme, you have to do that first.
Well, you develop it as your work goes along, but the sooner you develop it, the better.
Yeah. But I meant here, this, what was his name again?
Henderson.
Henderson.
Yes.
Comes or influences Cohn, and both of them and have a way of looking at how work is done.
Yes.
That's what I meant.
Right.
That you could just do something in a lab and not ask that somewhat larger question.
Oh, absolutely. And then you'd have a collection of individual results which might or might not fit together very well.
Yeah. So that must have been you say you got this in part by osmosis,
well,
so we're not necessarily conscious of it.
I was
at
not
the
necessarily
time.
Conscious of developing my own attitudes at the time, I guess. Now, something else was going on which influenced my eventual turn into the general subject of polymer physical chemistry, of which polymer viscoelasticity is a portion, and the principal portion that I've been concerned with. But I watched the development of the whole subject of polymer physical chemistry in the early 40s, due mostly to the work of Paul J. Florey, who much later received the Nobel Prize for a lifetime of work in polymer physical chemistry. He had just begun to publish a series of excellent papers, beginning with the theory of polymerization processes and going on to explanation of physical properties of polymers. And I read these papers with great care, and later when I started teaching polymer chemistry here, my course was based to a great extent on the papers of Florey. So I suppose his work gave me encouragement that the subject of polymers could develop into a very elegant quantitative discipline, which hadn't existed before.
I see. That's elegance is a term I've heard used a few times by scientists I've interviewed,
yes.
And that they seek for that.
Oh, it's a very important goal.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, indeed. Now, where do we want to?
Were you going to the meetings, the national meetings of the Chemical Association?
Well, yes, I often did, and I occasionally presented papers, but at that time I didn't have anything very exciting to talk about.
Did you meet
Oh, yes. I I knew a lot of people in the protein field because Dr. Cohn knew everybody, and he often invited them to Cambridge and to Boston. He was a rather wealthy person. I had a large house on Brattle Street, if you know Cambridge, and he would often have four or five distinguished scientists as house guests in his house, and sometimes he would invite his younger associates, such as me, to dinners there.
Goodness, and, that must have been wonderful.
It certainly was.
And they would also give talks, I suppose.
Oh, yes, yes.
Seminars.
So one was certainly in the very center of international activity in protein chemistry. Anything else that you think of?
Well, this is, let's see, this is about 19...
This was the years of 1936 to 1941.
Mm-hmm.
And toward the end, of course, the war had begun in Europe, and...
How did that, what was the impact, bit by bit, of that on you? You had traveled in Europe.
Well, I was terribly worried about how things were going, but I didn't... I didn't start doing anything about it until the summer of 1941, which I will come to presently. I'm sure that Dr. Cohn had already started thinking about what his role was going to be in as the war developed.
So he was a very considerable man. You described him as something of an entrepreneur, but his role was very crucial then in that lab.
Oh, absolutely.
Mm.
It would simply take us too far afield for me to talk to give a complete. Appraisal of
Dr.
Cohn.
Well, I suppose he's been written up.
And it has been written up. His biography for the National Academy. It was written by John T. Edsel, whose name I haven't mentioned up to now, but he was a member of the Cone Laboratory, and when I was a tutor in biochemical sciences, he was my superior as director of that program. Mm-hmm. And
yes, we were interrupted in mid-sentence.
Oh, I'm talking about John T. Mm-hmm. Edsel, who was a member of the Cone Laboratory and whose work and attitudes also influenced me during that period.
Should you say how, or do you want to go into that later?
I don't think there's any point in going into details. I'd have to stop and think for a long time to answer that question. But now perhaps I should turn to what happened as my junior fellowship came to a close, and the war effort was beginning, and I didn't know really what I was going to do next. At that time, Professor Alfred Redfield, who was a professor of biology at Harvard and whom I knew through various associations, came to Dr. Cone and said that he was looking for someone to go to Woods Hole to work on antifouling paint. Redfield, as well as being at Harvard, was associated with the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, which some people called the Harvard Boat Club because so many of the staff were Harvard faculty. The Navy was very concerned about developing improved methods for preventing barnacles and other things from attaching to ships, because they had had the experience of some seaplanes that had been in the water off the coast of Africa for a few days, and they got so coated with growth that they couldn't get up enough speed to take off. Mm. And in any case, for the Navy, it was extremely important to avoid fouling because of the decreased speed and increased fuel consumption that even a small amount of fouling produced, and the necessity of taking ships out of the water to scrape off the ship's bottoms. So a small research project had been started at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, but there was no one there who knew very much chemistry, and Cone told him that I was the best person for him to get for this purpose, and I was going to be at loose ends. I think of that time I may have had some arguments with Dr. Cone. I had some later. I can't remember whether he was beginning to cool off on his attitude toward me at that point, but anyway, it was
saying he might have wanted to get rid of you.
Exactly.
Oh.
Or at least for the time being. Mm-hmm. So and I didn't have any alternative at that point.
Had you applied to various places?
I hadn't really applied. I'd gone around and and talked to some people about work in other laboratories of well-known protein chemists, mm-hmm. but I didn't have any prospects of what is now called a tenure track appointment, mm-hmm. because in the first place departments were not expanding, and in the second place I really wanted to be in a department of chemistry, mm-hmm. and my work had been for several years separate from chemistry departments. Another aspect of this was that the Harvard chemistry faculty didn't like Dr. Cohn at all. And the fact that I was working with Cohn evidently was a black mark against any opportunity of my getting into the chemistry department, although I had some good friends in the younger faculty there. And
was it that they didn't respect him?
Yes, partly, I think. But in particular, they didn't like his style.
I'm curious, was he Jewish?
Yes, he was.
Was that, because I know that's been in that era,
well,
up to then, that was a factor often.
Yes. I don't know whether that was a factor. I'm sure it affected his career in some ways.
Phil Cohn has spoken about that eloquently here.
I see, yes. And that brings up some other things about the way he ran his laboratory. I was really amazed that when he had younger Jews working for him, he was very mean to them, and yet he was just all beaming and very pleasant to me and to the his non-Jewish younger people.
And you didn't think of going into the service, or did you, or was that any kind of factor?
Well, not really seriously, no. I might have thought about it briefly, but not seriously.
Well, a scientist wouldn't have to. I mean,
no, it was a question of waiting for the right position to mm-hmm. serve as a scientist.
And excuse me, were your arguments with him on scientific matters? On research directions?
No, I don't think so. I'm afraid I tend to forget things like that. And
oh, all right.
Maybe I'll think of something later. But another feature of trying to get into a chemistry department was that chemistry departments had no interest in polymers at that time. They thought that it had been true for decades, several decades in Germany, that the few people who were interested in polymers were not very respected.
Somebody's knocking at the door.
Yes, the idea that a polymer could exist had been put forward by a man named Staudinger at the University of Freiburg, and he had a very hard time convincing the chemical community that there could be such a thing as a polymeric molecule. And that attitude, I think, carried over into chemistry departments generally. Mm-hmm. There was really no basic work on polymers
It was certainly the case here, wasn't it?
Well, yeah, certainly here and anywhere in the United States. Mm-hmm. So.
Oh, that yes, that would be crucial, wouldn't it?
It would be. I could see that it was going to be very hard to get a position, and well, I simply accepted this opportunity mm-hmm. to go to Woods Hole, and so for several years, in fact, until almost till the end of the war, although later as I'll describe it, became a part-time job. I worked on with a group of biologists on development of antifouling paint.
Hmm.
This had an interesting aspect in that I felt I was on my own practically for the first time in my life, because at Harvard, it's such a wonderful place. If you have a question about something, you simply pick up the phone and you can find the world's expert to yeah. answer your question. And at Woods Hole, there wasn't anybody to yeah. turn to. In brief, the problem was something like what is now known as controlled drug delivery. The barnacles had to be kept off by poison. A number of other methods had been suggested, but none of them turned out to be satisfactory. And if the poison is not soluble in seawater, then of course it's not effective. If it is soluble in seawater, then it all dissolves. And
yeah.
and so it's necessary to have a slow release of the poison, which the poison which was almost universally used and we never got past it was copper.
Mm-hmm.
The Navy had cooked up a couple of recipes which worked pretty well, and in the end our contribution was to explain exactly how those recipes worked.
Mm.
And that's about as far as we got before the war was over. But
mm-hmm.
but we had a series of papers in industrial engineering chemistry published just after the end of the war, which described I think clearly exactly how these things were working and opened the way to future improvements. I haven't been in touch with the field since then, so I don't know what's happened.
So this was quite peripheral to your own interests again.
Completely. Again, I was off on a tangent which had nothing to do with my primary interests.
Mm-hmm.
But
how did you feel about it then? I mean, what?
Well,
being there.
I was accepting the situation. I didn't feel terribly frustrated about the delay of things I was really interested in,
mm-hmm.
because clearly this was an important problem for the war effort, though it wasn't the most glamorous.
Mm-hmm.
During that time, though, I wrote up some of the last experiments I had done at the Harvard Medical School on viscoelasticity of polymers, and they were published in the Journal of the American Chemical Society, and I think they attracted some attention as being quite a new kind of investigation.
Mm, I think you said somewhere that these were, these were important papers,
well,
or is that?
Well, they were important not for any particular application, but for opening up a rather new kind of investigation. Well, we're not making much progress in my lifetime, I'm afraid. I'm afraid this is going, if we continue at this rate, it's going to be one of your longer interviews.
I don't think we necessarily should continue at this rate, but it did seem interesting to find out about the Harvard experience because it seemed quite unusual. And then you must have gone into your blood plasma work.
Yes, that's the next thing I have to describe. Do you want to continue for a little longer today?
Yes, we have. Goodness.
I think I'd like to stop by about 10:45. Not
fine.
All right. Than
yes.
That. So, do you want to start it again? I will now describe how I went back to the Harvard Medical School part time.
Yes. All right.
Is it on?
Yes, it is.
Oh, I see. It was toward the end of 1942, I think. By this time, of course, we had entered the war in December of 42, that Dr. Cohn said he'd like to have me come back part time because something had developed in which I might be particularly interested. At that time, he had a huge enterprise supported by the Armed Services in which human blood plasma was being fractionated into different protein components. Probably Dr. Williams has described this to you, really?
When I talked to him, it wasn't with this kind of plan to go into his research, to my great regret.
There were six pharmaceutical firms plus Armour and Company, which of course normally dealt with bovine and blood and other animal bloods, but at this time had taken up the processing of human blood. These seven companies were processing human blood plasma supplied by the Red Cross and dividing it into different fractions of the proteins which it contains. The reason was primarily that by separating out the human albumin, a product could be obtained which was much more convenient for medical use than the whole blood plasma. It was much more stable. It could be bottled as a liquid solution so that it could be injected directly into the veins and thereby treat emergency cases immediately, whereas the blood plasma, which had to be stored in the dry state, had to be reconstituted with water. And that took quite a long time to fill up a bottle containing the dried material, add the water. It took a long time to dissolve. So the albumin was of enormous value for treating war injuries. But when you separate out the albumin, there are other byproducts. And the first byproduct that comes out contains the fibrinogen, which is the protein responsible for forming a blood clot. And this was just being thrown away, which was a terrible waste, and there were other things that were being thrown away too, but that's beside the... And uses for those were developed, including the gamma globulin, which is widely used in medicine today. So I was called back approximately half time to work on developing possible uses for fibrinogen and the fibrin, which is made when fibrinogen is clotted, in the ordinary blood clot, of course, all the other things in blood are present in this gel-like structure that's formed when the enzyme thrombin acts on fibrinogen. But now there was a fairly highly purified fibrinogen material, which had none of the other, or not very many of the other blood components in it. It would make a beautiful clear solution. You could add the enzyme thrombin, and it would make a beautiful clot, which was colorless. It might be either transparent or opaque, depending on the circumstances. And the question is, what could be done with this material? I had a collaborator in this, a man named Peter Morrison, who was a graduate student. In fact, he was a student of Professor Redfield's, whose name I mentioned before, working for the PhD. And he was deferred from war service in the middle of his PhD work to work with me on applications of fibrinogen and fibrin. This is all described in one of the things I gave you, so perhaps I don't need to go into further detail, except to say that we did develop something called fibrin film, which was a rubbery sheet of material constituting pure human fibrin, which it turned out was very useful in brain surgery, because it could be put over the exposed brain and would form a benign coating for which they hadn't been able to get anything else up to that point. And then after an operation, it was absorbed with no deleterious effects, and gradually and replaced by growing back a normal physiological membrane.
Well, maybe this is a time to ask how first your recognition of what you had and what it was, and then of how it might be used. Can you remember those processes?
Well, I think it probably started by looking for something to treat burns with, because when large areas of skin were destroyed by burns, this of course results in a very serious condition, and we were trying to make sheets of fibrin that could be used to cover burns.
Somebody had suggested that you try to do this. Do you remember who it was who suggested it?
Well, no. We had contacts with a lot of MDs at that point, and of course,
so it would be somebody calling up the lab and saying, "You fellows ought to find some way of treating burns."
Well,
so
yes, it was. It's hard to sort anything out, because the Cone Laboratory by this time was a very exciting place compared with the rather quiet place with just a few people working, as I had known it in the late 1930s. Now it had expanded in the medical school, taken over more space, and there were representatives of the Navy there checking on the production of these blood components in all the seven different industrial firms, and there were MDs coming in all the time to consult on various problems.
So did you two have your own lab?
Morrison and I had one room where we...
And people would come in and say, "How are you doing?"
Well, yes. And then we would give reports every week. There was a general meeting in in Dr. Cohn's large office, of which would be devoted to some particular subject, and there would be a lot of laboratory staff and various MDs sitting in at the same time, and also there were meetings in Washington all the time, and bulletins, reports to Washington and reports from Washington. Dr. Cohn was always going to Washington, and sometimes some of us would go to meetings usually held at the National Academy of Sciences. I was in the National Academy building far more often in those days than later when I was elected to membership in the Academy.
Did you find this awesome or?
Well, exciting and mm-hmm. interesting. I wouldn't say exactly awesome.
Is there any kind of eureka moment in connection with this, discovering what you had?
Well, it didn't come all in the same moment, but I haven't come to describing what we found that really was useful.
It's
written up, but the point is that we were working with sheets of fibrin, and I guess the brain surgeons must have said, that's what we need to go over the brain. And so Morrison and I made sheets, but then the question was, how are we going to sterilize them?
Uh-huh.
And because if you're putting something on a burn, you don't worry about sterilization because it's covered with infection anyway. But if you're going to put something over the brain, it's got to be absolutely sterile. And we worked out a very crude method of dipping the fibrin sheets into hot glycerol, which would be hot enough to sterilize, and then packaging them aseptically, which was terrible. And it was awfully messy and could never be done on a large scale basis. But some of these were used first in monkeys, showed that they were benign, and then they were put in a few patients.
Mm-hmm.
And one patient developed permanent damage, and
because it wasn't sterile.
I don't know what was wrong with it. Maybe it had been chemically altered by the hot glycerol, and Dr. Cohn, of course, was very displeased by this development, but we scurried around and by several weeks or maybe months' work, discovered that there was a way to sterilize the material. It was rather elaborate. You had to dry it to a certain extent, dry the fibrin film. Of course, these sheets had to be kept wet, either with water or with glycerol, because if they became completely dry, a very brittle material was formed which was irreversibly altered. But if we dried it just enough and then heated it just enough, we could get a sterilized material which could be reconstituted with saline solution. And are we coming to the end? Shall I stop then?
You can finish your sentence.
Yes. Well, and anyway, we did get a successful method.
Mm-hmm.
And then these things were produced in quantity by several by several industrial companies, and mm-hmm. and the it was used very widely in brain surgery during the war. So that was our eureka,
yeah.
but it didn't come all at once.
Uh-huh.